ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesel required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. The liberation of Belsen in the last days of the war in Europe was seen by the world as a great humanitarian triumph for the Allies, and particularly the British, who took charge of the tens of thousands of starving prisoners in the camp. But the acclaimed author Nadia Wheatley casts a very different light on the fate of the prisoners in her new book, Strange New World, Belsen's First Year of Freedom. Saved, they said of themselves, but not liberated. And that time in Belsen bears on the formation of Israel. Nadia Wheatley joins me later. But first, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has an army to face down Hamas, Hezbollah and Iran. But in October, he must face his own people. Predictions of his fate at the ballot box have been radically revised in the last week or so, after two former prime ministers, Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, from two different parties, joined forces in a new party, Be'ahed, together to unseat Netanyahu's coalition. Or so they hope. To discuss politics today inside Israel, I'm joined by Iris Mackler once again. Iris, veteran Middle East correspondent, including for the ABC, who is now based in Sydney. Iris, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, who are these two characters?
They are not as little known as you might think. They both went into politics, that is, into the Israeli parliament in the same year, in 2013. They both were together in various governments since then. But they're a new generation, including both being prime ministers, by the way, in that small period of time when Benjamin Netanyahu has not been in office. So 2021, 2022. So they're known quantities, but they're a younger, a different generation, early 50s, early 60s. Benjamin Netanyahu, now 77 years old. So it's like a next generation, one quite not religious, one quite right-wing, Naftali Bennett, former head of the Settlers Council. So that's the West Bank Settlers Organisation. And he's also, I suppose you'd call him a tech bro today. Then he was just a tech entrepreneur, made a lot of money that way, and then went into right-wing politics. Like many people in Israeli politics today, he was actually in Netanyahu's office and then fell out as in, you know, informed his own party. That's another common way to get to Israeli politics.
And what's Lapid's?
Lapid's antecedents are a father who was a journalist and then a politician, and Lapid became a journalist and then a politician. So it's in the family story. And like someone who was, I can't even think of an Australian equivalent. He did a lot of light entertainment. He wrote books, he wrote songs, and he was fronted a news program. But he wasn't a serious, serious journalist. He was a very well-read columnist. And then he went into politics and is now leader of the opposition.
Are either of these men peaceniks?
No, neither. I would say neither. Naftali Bennett is a right winger. Yair Lapid is a centre stroke, even centre left in Israeli terms. I think, you know, I think what's hanging over this election is one word, and that's Hungary. So everybody here in Israel looks across at the victory against Orban, against a leader of 16 years who seemed immovable, and they're given quite a bit of heart by that, all the opponents of Netanyahu. And the lesson they're taking from, well, there's two lessons really, but the lesson they're taking from Hungary is you can be even in the same party as the leader And if you leave, it doesn't matter as long as what you're offering is a real alternative. And it's not left and right in classic terms. It's more, do you believe it? Pieter Mozsor persuaded the Hungarians was that he was anti-corruption and believed in democratic institutions. So it wasn't left and right. It doesn't matter that he was in Orbán's party. And it's the same here. It's not necessarily left and right. It's whether you can persuade the public that you are a real alternative to Netanyahu. And the other lesson from Hungary is that everybody, it should be unified. All the opposition parties should get together in one party. Whether this actually applies to Israel or not, I'm not sure, but that's the lesson that's being debated. Form one party, get everyone behind you, defeat Benjamin Netanyahu.
But very deliberately this time, there appears to have been no overtures to the Arab parties in the Knesset to join the opposition to Netanyahu. This is a Jewish operation, am I right?
In fact, these particular two, when they were previously in government, Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, were sitting with an Arab party, the only Arab party who agrees to sit in government. So there are Arab parties that stand for the parliament, but they don't sit in government. That's been their policy. The first person to change that was Mansour Abbas. Very interesting, you know, from an Islamist party in the south of the country. Very unusual politician. There were overtures to him by Benjamin Netanyahu at the time. But the party he chose and the party he went with, or the government he chose, was that led by Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid. And that has been a bone of contention ever since. And I don't know that many Jewish parties would succeed in sitting with an Arab party, with Mansour Abbas this time.
But can they get the numbers without sitting with the Arab parties?
That's the issue, and that was the issue then too. They couldn't. They didn't have the numbers. In fact, Naftali Bennett had only 6 seats, but he was lured in to become prime minister because without his 6 seats, without Mansour Abbas's small number of seats too, they simply couldn't get that opposition to Netanyahu up. And now they are hoping, I guess with this move, there are other politicians as well, but they're hoping to unify the centre in a Jewish operation, as you put it, as opposed to a multi-party operation.
And they're not offering peace.
They're not even discussing it. I think their main aim is to change this coalition government, which is very hard right, and has been led by Benjamin Netanyahu in some iteration or other for a very long time. I don't know, David, you have to have lived in a country that has one ruler for so long to understand how oppressive it is.
I grew up under Bob Menzies. I mean, don't talk to me like that as if I'm inexperienced in this phenomenon.
Well, then you know. And Bob, you know, he had his drawbacks. But it's a different thing if you are living under Orbán in Hungary, or I'd suggest living under Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel if you don't agree with him.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
So I think the impetus to remove him for the centre parties, for the people who are talking about an equality with the ultra-Orthodox, all those internal issues are very important, and I think they predominate.
But would the Together Party represent or, you know, embody in some way any of the criticisms of Israel that are now so common around the world? The savagery of the way in which they are fighting, the perpetual wars, the ways in which they are dealing with Palestinians. I mean, is there anything that either of those men are proposing that would radically change the world's judgment of Israel?
At this point, it's very hard to say, partly because we haven't heard, you know, clear policy, a description of any of the things you're describing from them. I'm not optimistic that they would be, that I could reply to you and say, yes, they're going to answer all those questions. I don't see that. Interestingly, there is one wild card, if you like, on that centre-right area that we're discussing. Because if you look at Israeli politics, the right-wing and the ultra-right and the ultra-Orthodox, they're not going to move to the centre. The left-wing are pretty firm, smaller but firm. So it's these centre, it's these swinging voters in the centre that you have to attract in order to unseat Netanyahu, and that's who they're going for. And the wild card in all of that is a former chief of staff called military chief of staff, whose name is Gadi Eisenkot. He's currently possibly the most popular politician in Israel. He lost a son during the Gaza war and a nephew actually as well. So he has that public sympathy for a bereaved father. He handled all that with great grace. I saw an interview with him at the time. So he's very popular, and it's not clear where he's going to end up because he's in a party that's dissolving at the moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, Iris did some things with her hands which looked like the untangling of some yarn.
Dissolving, perhaps.
If we could put that into words, roughly what are his politics?
So he is, you'd call him a hawkish left-winger, I guess. But it's back to what I said about it's not left and right in any sense that we understand those words perhaps here. He does believe in the institutions of the country, the democratic institutions. He is hawkish on Israeli security. He did believe in this Gaza war and the need for a war with Iran. So those are what we would call more right-wing views, but in the context of Israel at the moment, I suppose you'd say security-focused.
So there's no point in looking at change here as some kind of radical change to the way in which Israel's been behaving in the last couple of years.
I think, given the length of time that Benjamin Netanyahu has been in power, given the extent to which he dominates Israeli politics and Israeli institutions, some argue coherently to their detriment. I think that the removal of Benjamin Netanyahu from office, if they can achieve it, that's not a done deal. We can talk about polling and its complexities.
My next questions.
Excellent. But if they can achieve that, that is a radical change in itself.
Yep. What is the polling?
The polling is confusing because there are two sets of polls, one of which shows what has been consistently shown, which is that Benjamin Netanyahu would not become the next Prime Minister of Israel. And it's that prognosis which has kept this particular government in office, you know, for the full four-year term, which is almost unheard of in Israeli politics. But the more unpopular the government is, the longer it survives because it's got nowhere else to go. No one's going to blow it up, and no one has. So that's one set of polling. A second set of polling, and that polling is based on, if people say don't know, they throw out that answer. So if you say, I don't know who the next prime minister should be, we don't count you at all.
Right.
The second set of polling, which gives a much better chance to Benjamin Netanyahu, does, I guess, an Australian thing. They second guess what would happen based on other answers.
What's the probability of the don't know?
Yeah. Where's the don't know going? And on that basis, they say Benjamin Netanyahu has a much better chance.
What do the people of Israel think of stunts like Ben-Gvir's wife giving him a birthday cake with a noose on it?
You know, it's back to what does it... Because the range, the tribes, there's so many tribes in Israel and their views are quite different to each other. I think all the Ben-Gvir voters would think that was great. And I think there are a number of Israelis all the way back into the Likud, you know, into Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing party, who would not think that was great. So you've got an array of responses based on where you stand.
And they've already made up their minds, so it's not going to, you know, celebrating the possibility of executing Palestinians on a birthday cake. That's just something that the Ben-Gvirists do. So,
well, they are Kahanists. You know, they are. It's like bringing the Ku Klux Klan into Israeli politics, another achievement of Benjamin Netanyahu, by the way. He was the midwife to bringing this man into this government. So if you have the Ku Klux Klan in politics, you're not surprised by their racist views. That's how I would put it. And that's why previous governments, previous Israeli parliaments, kept these Kahanists, as they're called, and the original mayor Kahana, the racist rabbi, they kept him out of the parliament. It was a huge thing when Netanyahu brought this man into the parliament. And that's why, you know, it's the middle ground that will determine this election.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Iris Makler about the politics of Israel now. Netanyahu has asked the president for a pardon. Remind us what charges he's facing. Remind us how he has managed that for these trials never to come to fruition, and what are his chances of getting a pardon?
Let's go back to the charges. Let's start with the charges. So there are three different corruption cases. It's been going, it first went to court in May 2020. So that's 6 years ago now. It's now in its seventh year, this case. Partly because it's complicated, there's three cases. Partly because he is very obstructive. He always said he could be both be charged and go to court and be the prime minister and do his job. But what we've seen is that he can't come, you know, he's got backache, he's just come back from Washington, he's got a variety of reasons, dog ate my homework kind of reasons for not being in court. So he's now, for example, just this week was meant to be in court, said no, he couldn't. The court said, well, can you come for half a day, if not a whole day? So on and on this goes, this pulling, this dragging out of this court case. And there has been pressure on Israel's president to arrange a pardon. And what the president has said is, before I do a pardon, you have to discuss a plea deal. And nobody really wanted this plea deal, but we have this week heard from the Attorney General that she's prepared to discuss a plea deal.
What does a plea deal mean? Does it mean an admission of guilt?
That's exactly the nub of the issue. He would say, no, it shouldn't include that. She would say, yes, it should. And she said, no preconditions. So if we're going to do two things, the court case goes on as slowly as, you know, goes on as slowly as it has been, and no preconditions. You know, I'm not making any assurances like that. So I have heard two Israeli analysts saying that he would like that and would like a kind of sinecure that if he didn't stand again for, I mean, I imagine that would be the deal, you can no longer stand for in the role of prime minister, he wouldn't mind being president.
The question about, I mean, it's a ravishing prospect that Netanyahu may one day be the president of Israel, but would his health stand it?
Well, that's, you know, there it is. If he goes to, if he is found guilty, he could be spending his 80th birthday in prison. Just think of that. He's now 77 years old. When about 2023, there was all this, is he sick? Isn't he sick? What's going on? And he had a pacemaker put in, but we were only told about it afterwards. Now, after the fact, we've just heard this month that he had treatment for prostate cancer, yeah, which he assures everyone is fine and he's better. But he hasn't got a good track record of revealing the truth. Yep. So he's 77 years old with a pacemaker and prostate issues. And you would have to have that concentrating your mind. It must be said that I've been watching him for a very long time. I don't think he looks well. I think he looks haggard, exhausted, and he doesn't look well every time I see him.
A perfectly healthy man fighting a war on how many fronts would probably look haggard too, Iris.
No, that's exactly right. I remember when I was there, I was so exhausted and I was reporting.
From just reporting them, let alone directing them.
No, and I would look at him and I'd think, I'm not up all night filing, and I'm only filing. You are running this war. How are you even standing?
If he were to step down, if something were to intervene, who would take over from him in the coalition he now runs?
There isn't much time. If he were to step down, you know, we're talking now, we're May, the elections are in October. There is a system within the Likud, and it's the second person in the Likud which could actually be changes. The last time I looked, it was Yariv Levin, the very controversial justice minister, the one who was pushing the judicial reforms.
Right, trying to gut the High Court.
Indeed, that was its aim.
And there is no possibility that Netanyahu could negotiate some kind of fresh coalition that would bring in the followers of Lapid and Bennett.
That's why there were five elections in the space of 2 years, because the followers of Lapid and Bennett at that stage in their previous iterations didn't agree to sit with Netanyahu because of all this corruption story. So would they now agree to sit with him? Some people say, yes, we should, because what we have to do is get rid of the far right. That's an argument.
And rein Netanyahu in.
Rein Netanyahu in, bring him back to the centre, not let the far right agenda control this country. So that's one. That is one position that's actually being argued for strongly. And other people say, no, it's now a toxic leadership and it must go. And we maintain the position that we had before, which is we can't sit with him.
A last question. Why did these two men who teamed up before, who beat Netanyahu at the polls, why did they their government only last, what, 18 months or something before it collapsed?
They had a majority of one. Benjamin Netanyahu was a very, very tough opposition leader, much tougher than they ever were to him. So the opposition never voted on any issue. And it was just very hard to keep running. And one of the there was an issue that brought them to breaking point, but I would have said it was only a matter of time. That issue was not something. It would have happened inevitably anyhow.
Yes, but were they able to legislate anything? I mean, were they able to actually function as a government?
Yeah, they did function as a government, not always effectively, but they did function as a government. They signed a deal with Lebanon, a gas deal that was actually quite controversial. Benjamin Netanyahu said he would never have signed it, but in fact it was being negotiated when he was prime minister, so I don't think that was exactly true.
So you've come all this way into Late Night Live, Iris, to tell us in your deeply informed way, with absolute precision, that anything could happen.
I'm afraid that's true.
Iris, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been talking to the veteran Middle East correspondent Iris Makler about the state of politics in Israel today. Coming up, Belson after the liberation. Three weeks before the war ended, the Germans invited the British to liberate the 60,000 prisoners, mostly Jews, being held at Belsen. What they found was appalling beyond any measure. Skeletal men and women gathered at the wire, corpses lying about in heaps, a pervading stench of death, and 10,000 or so men and women stricken with typhus, or as it was known at the time, Jewish fever. Nadia Wheatley's new book, Strange New World, Belsen's First Year of Freedom, challenges assumption after assumption about the way the British dealt with the prisoners, now called displaced persons. They refused for as long as they could to recognise the Jews as Jews. And Nadia charts the role of Belsen's Jews in winning support around the world for the founding of Israel. Nadia joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
What was Belsen? What kind of camp?
Okay. Bergen-Belsen, as we'll call the concentration camp, was in northwest Germany. So it was in the land of the Reich. It wasn't over in the east. So Bergen-Belsen was not an extermination camp. It was not a place of gas chambers. It was a place, a holding camp initially for Jewish people. But by 1945, by the beginning of 1945, as the Soviets were moving in from the east, a large number of people who'd been in extermination camps, notably Auschwitz, were moved to Belsen in what were called the death marches. And so by 1945, Bergen-Belsen contained some 45,000 in the main campsite and 15,000 at another site of people who came from other camps as well as old hands from Bergen-Belsen. These people were primarily Jewish. So we can't do an exact number count, but probably half to two-thirds were Jewish.
And you estimate in the book that in the months before the British arrived, something like 35,000 people had died there.
That's not my statistic. It's by a German historian called Eberhard Kolb, who was the first real historian of the camp. So, yes, that is a very reliable German figure for the numbers who died from about late 44 up to liberation, April 45. And what they were dying of to a great degree was starvation and the disease of typhus.
Explain what typhus is, what it does.
It's a highly contagious disease which is passed on by lice. So it's passed on by body contact, the lice in your hair, the lice in your clothing, but also lice feces in the very dust that you're walking on. And so it was infecting people at a great rate. It came into the camp in early 45 as people came in on the death marches.
And what does it do?
It gives you hallucinations, it gives you fever. It's not necessarily fatal, but it will create a very long 2 or 3 weeks of extraordinary fever, which may lead to post-typhus death. It can lead to deafness, it can lead to tinnitus, and psychological problems.
And it was the fear of the prisoners breaking out and fleeing into Germany. It was the fear of the spread of typhus, you argue, that got the Germans to, at the only point in the war ever, invite the British to take command of the camp.
Yes, again, that German historian Kolb calls this the unique situation whereby the Germans offered a truce to the British in the Second World War, offering them land, territory and a camp. There were two reasons. One was that Himmler, who was in charge of the SS, in charge of the concentration camps, naively thought that he could use this as a trading card. He could see by April that the war was going the wrong way for the Germans, and he thought that the British might let him off lightly if he gave them something. So he'd give them a concentration camp. More significantly, the Germans had a phobia about what they called Judenfieber, Jewish fever, and they feared that if the British rolled in their tanks, knocked down the fences, liberated the prisoners, then the prisoners, whether Jewish or not, would go into the countryside and infect the civilian Germans.
Now, the war was still going on, as I said, when the British arrived at Belsen, Bergen-Belsen. And you paint a picture in the book of a terrible lack of understanding on the part of the British, a lack of preparation, a blundering first response to the challenge they found there. But I wonder, given that the war was still going on, whether the British can be blamed for this.
Okay, this is a very contentious point, and my book is a revisionist history. It revises the standard British narrative, which presents the liberation of Bergen-Belsen as the jewel in the crown of British victory over Hitler, and it even rewrites the story of World War II and presents this as the reason why we made war against Hitler. So the story from my point of view is that they had this truce. They had 3 days' knowledge that they were going into the camp. This is not a situation anyone had in relation to other camps. They were told that there were 1,500 typhus cases. Now, that may not seem much to a lay outsider, but when the British previously knew of 250 cases only in the occupied city of Cologne, they had gone all out and disinfected by means of DDT 10,000 people in a nearby town. So 1,500 typhus cases was a big deal. Now, what was the state of the war? Well, the bit of the army we're talking about is the bit of the Second Army called British 8th Corps. And the head of 8th Corps, the commander Barker, at exactly this time, sent a letter around to all his troops, including the head of the medical service, saying, "We've got the Hun on the run. We've beaten the Hun. They've got their white flags out." So by this stage, by mid-April 1945, really the British were in a situation of knowing the war was won. Certainly Himmler knew the war was lost. But instead of preparing for a camp where they knew that there was 1,500 typhus cases,
which was a gross underestimation,
It proved to be a gross underestimation, and in fact the British administrator underestimated it even more. But knowing there were 1,500 cases there, there were protocols. There were written protocols that had been developed in late 44, whereby certain chain of command alerts had to be sent up if there was any typhus at all, back to rear headquarters. That was not done by Brigadier Glenn Hughes, who was a war hero, medico in the Royal Army Medical Corps, but he was not an administrator. So it was a snafu, as we'd call it in medical military terms, from day one. He sent in a single medical unit, which was a field hygiene unit, with one doctor. But what the Army did send in was the Army Film and Photographic Unit. So they started to use the propaganda of the liberation from day one, but they didn't start the medical effort rolling until about day three.
There was also, I learned from the book, just an appalling tragedy of feeding the prisoners in the first couple of days. They gave them the wrong food.
Yes, so again we should ask, what would army bods know about starving prisoners? Would they be aware that if people are starving, you've got to be very gentle on what you start to feed them? Yes, they were aware, because they already knew that there were British prisoners of war that the Japanese were holding in Asia, and they were preparing in advance in April for what they would feed to the British prisoners when they were liberated. So they knew that when people were liberated, they should only have small amounts of gentle food. Day one, they took no food at all. Okay, that was ill preparation. Day two, they kind of panicked and sent through, in the darkness of day two, they threw in these big American Army ration packs, each of which contained 24 small crates with tins of greasy stew and tins of biscuits. So people overfed. They were starving. They'd been starving for weeks and months. Some people just ripped open the tins and ate them. By the estimate of Major Burney, who was one of the British liberators in charge of that effort, who felt terrible, he was actually of Jewish origin, he estimated that 2,000 people died immediately of overeating. But a Dutch prisoner representative estimated that 4,000 to 5,000 people died.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Nadia Wheatley about her challenging, extraordinary book about the first year after the liberation of Belsen. Nadia, there was also this extraordinary determination by the British not to tell the world that Belsen was full of Jews. What on earth was that about?
Well, David, as a journalist, you'd know about D-notices. So the British Ministry of Information had the equivalent of a D-notice, which dictated that stories about the enemy's atrocities, such as the camps, and I'm quoting, must deal with indisputably innocent people, not with violent political opponents such as socialists and communists, and not with Jews. So it was not allowed to be said that there were Jews being liberated. And when the great British journalist, BBC journalist, went in,
Richard Dimbleby.
Yes, went in on the second day, and he sent back an account to be read out on the BBC, and he mentioned that the majority were Jewish. That bit of his account was edited out before it was broadcast.
But Nadia, why was that the orders of the British? I mean, they appeared to be lumping the Jews in with criminals. Was that just fundamental distaste for Jews, anti-Semitism?
There is a systemic anti-Semitism running through this story. There's also a kind of mindset of colonialism. So it's a very British mix that we've got going on here. And there's also what I call a fundamentalist British liberalism going on. So they were in denial about the identity of Jewish people, but they were also maintaining that Jewish people had to be registered by their nationality, not by their Jewishness. They would not accept that either by race or by religion, Jews were an identity, a community in themselves.
Why?
Why? Well, it was the combination of people who had been running colonies for years. So basically any of these people who were the other, who were seen as being not British, were an inferior race. But it also was this an anti-Semitism was just running through the whole system from the top to the bottom. This is not to say that by any means all the liberators or the majority were personally anti-Semitic, but this was a mindset which meant that when British organisations in Britain from the first week after liberation were asking to go into Belsen to offer relief and to see who was around in the camps, the British Brigadier in charge of civil affairs wrote, "No one wants a visit from these people." So these were who Jews were. Jews were these people, the other.
And they were not welcome at Belsen.
They were not allowed officially into Belsen as relief units until August. So we've got from April until August until you've got Jewish organisations going in. Meanwhile, you had medical students, you had the British Red Cross, you had all sorts, you had Swiss Medical Mission, you had all sorts of non-Jewish organisations were allowed in to help. But Jewish organisations were not allowed in until July, August.
The British at this stage were facing what must have seemed absolutely frustrating, that essentially hardly anybody in Belsen wanted to go home.
Yes, well, it wasn't only in Belsen that liberated people didn't want to go home. What you had in Europe in May, June 1945 was between 8 and 13 million displaced persons, and by winter, there were still at least a million people refusing to go home. So non-Jewish people who came from countries that were now in the Soviet Union, notably Poland and the Ukraine, were not wanting to go back to a Soviet homeland. And but for the Jews, there was an extra sort of ratchet in this opposition to repatriation, because their families, their communities in the Jewish shtetls, particularly in Poland, were not there any longer.
Completely destroyed.
And pogroms were already breaking out in Poland by August 45.
Fresh pogroms against
Jews.
Yes. They didn't want to go back there.
Where
they wanted to go was Palestine.
Indeed. Where they wanted to go was Palestine, and some were saying, if we can't go to Palestine, we'd rather go back to Auschwitz.
What was the British position at this point about allowing Jews into Palestine?
In 1945, the British, who were still running Palestine as the mandate that had been set up under the Balfour Declaration of 1917, was allowing in a certain number of Jewish immigrants to Palestine every month, about 1,500 a month. But the numbers who were wanting to go to Palestine was rapidly escalating. Here I should say that if other countries in the world, notably Australia, Canada, and the United States, had been offering to take Jews in 1945, many would have instantly taken the ticket.
And but we weren't. And Australia wasn't.
Well, specifically, Corwell didn't want Jews. That's on the record, that he didn't want Jews to come here. In America and Canada and Britain as well, Jews were not welcome. So Palestine became for those countries a place that they could get rid of this problem and offload the problem. The attitude of the British was starting to be to just throw up their hands in horror and want to get out of Palestine.
But meanwhile, they were not going to accede to the demands of Jewish displaced persons to be sent there. I mean, that was not happening.
No. So the turnaround started to happen very much with Belsen camp. So you've got a situation in which the British government became in a kind of pincer movement between what was going on from the Jewish resistance in Palestine, led by people such as David Ben-Gurion, who were starting to become increasingly militant in demanding to have Eretz Israel. And the British were also caught in this movement from the Jews in Belsen, led by a charismatic, amazing politician by the name of Joseph Rosenzaft. Now, here we come back to what I mentioned earlier about the publicity campaign that the British did on the liberation. So within, by the second day, when they had Richard Dimbleby, they have other press, they have documentary makers, pictures of the liberation, the glories of British liberation were going back to the British public and were appearing in the matinee newsreels in British cinemas before VE Day. This amazing publicity campaign within a few months rebounded on the British because the name Belsen, which became the name of the displaced persons camp to which they were moved 2 kilometres up the road, the name of Belsen had brand recognition in Britain. And so when this tiny little group, a group called the Central Jewish Committee, led by this man, Joseph Rosenzaft, and his wife, Hadassah Bimko, who was a doctor, when this tiny little group started to pressure the British for a Jewish camp in Belsen, they wanted a segregated Jewish-only camp in Belsen.
Because apart from anything, they were experiencing anti-Semitic attacks from Polish non-Jewish prisoners.
Yes, they were experiencing what they called pogroms within Belsen DP camp, attacks, brutality. They wanted a Jewish homeland inside Belsen DP camp, and they wanted a Jewish homeland in what they called Eretz Israel. So it had an enormous effect on the British government. Now, this was a context, and British liberation Holocaust historian Dan Stone argues that despite the enormous factors that played into the creation of Israel, he argues that the liberation of the camps, the displaced persons, had an enormous effect on the creation of Israel. I would say that this minuscule microcosm of Belsen was the cutting edge of that. This particularly came to the fore in July 1946 when the newly elected President Truman in the United States wanted to know what was going on in the conditions of Jews in camps in the US zone and in the British zone. So he sent over to Germany an emissary called Earl Harrison, who was Dean of Law at Harvard, a non-Jewish person.
A profoundly Christian man.
Yes, a Presbyterian who later became a Quaker. And Harrison visited the camps in the American zone while a Jewish organisation man called Joseph Schwartz visited the British zone. There was finally one day left. Harrison came to meet Schwartz in the British zone and he asked to see Belsen. People were just interested to see Belsen.
Because it was famous.
Yes, it was notorious. By now, the old concentration camp had been burnt down when all the survivors had been moved to the displaced persons
Ceremonially
camp.
Burnt down.
Ceremonially burnt down with flamethrowers. So by now, the word Belsen was a bit ambiguous. Did it mean the old concentration camp or the new displaced persons camp? So Harrison goes to what is the displaced persons camp with a British military rabbi and with the Jewish organisation representative. There he meets Joseph Rosenzaft and about 30 others representing not just Jews in the camp but also people from the German Jewish communities scattered around from nearby towns. That day, and in my book I include his handwritten journal account of that day, was, I think, one of the most significant days that played into the creation of Israel. So Harrison chain-smoked with tears running down his face as he listened to the people telling him about their experiences in the camps and what they wanted. And in his handwritten notes that he wrote up that night, he wrote, number one, peace and quiet, live out remaining years. So that's what they wanted. Number two, and this is in quote marks, can't go back, anti-S, anti-Semitism, parents killed, land soaked with Jewish blood, don't leave us in this bloody region. So that was what Harrison wrote that night. Within a few days, he wrote his report to Truman, which wasn't lodged till the end of August, but it was written straight after he was in Belsen. And he concluded his report by saying, quote again, the only real solution of the problem of the Jewish DPs lies in the quick evacuation of all non-repatriable Jews in Germany and Austria who wish it to Palestine. This resulted in something called the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry, which in turn led to the major committee that went around and interviewed people in Arabs in Palestine, so-called, and Jewish people in the camps and in Palestine about what they wanted. And basically, the United Nations decision to participate, to petition the land, came out of those deliberations.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Nadia Weekly about her book Strange New World, Belsen's First Year of Freedom. Back into the camp, you have the advantage of remarkable material, some of it provided by a bunch of final year medical students who were shipped in from England in those first weeks. Tell us about the boys.
So amongst the volunteers who came, there were 96 final year medical students who had been preparing to feed people in Holland with liquid food. So we come back to the fact that the authorities did know that starving people could only have small amounts of liquid food. They had been prepared to do that, and then suddenly, late April, early May, they were sent to Belsen to work in the camp of the old concentration camp, where frankly, until then, the Royal Army Medical Corps had not worked. And so you had people who had been left to die. The policy of the brigadier running the medical relief effort, the policy of the British was what we would see now as an inverted triage policy, whereby those who were deemed not likely to live were just left to die in the old camp. So you had some 10,000 people still living in huts that were ankle deep in feces, living in huts where there were four typhus-infested people lying in the same bunk. And it was into those places that these young medical students went. And what you had is youth speaking to youth, because the very old and the very young people in Bergen-Belsen had died. So that the survivors were young adults, these men were young adults, they came with a fresh approach, they used to get roaring drunk at night, they made a raft to sail on the lake, they made a raft out of beer barrels, they were medical students, rugger buggers. But they got in there, they cleaned up the huts, and they started to speak to the patients. They asked them their names, and instead of feeding them these terrible products that were part of a research project, they cut up little bits of white bread and put honey on them and fed them individually.
There was a loathing of the black bread that was usually supplied there. And there was this horrible stuff that was pumped into people's veins, which didn't seem to do very much at all. But on the spot, there were German doctors and nurses. How did the displaced persons find it to be being treated by Germans?
From the first few days of examining conditions at Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, the so-called horror camp, the brigadier in charge decided that he would use German doctors and nurses who would be liberated from prisoner of war camps once the war would end to help with the medical relief effort. In a way, this was possibly seen as a form of retribution, but it was also going to be a solution to mean that he didn't have to employ many of his own British military persons. There were in the displaced persons camp at least 100 DP doctors, and there were many hundreds who worked as volunteer nurses and orderlies in the first days of liberation. But the British chose to employ German nurses, some 150 German nurses in the Glenhuys Hospital, and British and German doctors. This was actually a very controversial topic while my father was superintendent. So he was criticised rightly in Aufbau, which was a Yiddish journal published in New York, for employing German medical personnel German nurses instead of DP personnel.
So there were Jewish German, there were Jewish doctors and nurses available, but they weren't used. They brought in Germans instead.
There were certainly Jewish doctors and nurses who could have been invited in from England, for example, but the British authorities wouldn't have Jewish relief efforts going into the camp.
Nadia, oh, there's so much I'd like to talk about. The camp was rife with gonorrhea. There were so many extraordinary things going on in the camp, but I want you to explain what your connection to Belsen is.
Okay, so I have a bit of skin in this game, which I discovered after the death of my father. I had a very poor relationship with my father, who was a very unpleasant and in fact, anti-Semitic person. He was a doctor, a British doctor, with whom I didn't really live very much for much of my childhood. After his death in 1983, his widow sent me some newspaper reports that had come out in his hometown in England, and in one of them I read that he had been medical superintendent of the hospital in Belsen Displaced Persons Camp. So I quickly say not the concentration camp, but the DP camp. I went to the site of the old Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in 2014, looking for my father's hospital. At that time, I didn't realise that there were two completely different geographic structures, two different camps. What I found at what you would find at Bergen-Belsen these days on the memorial site is what I find to be a very beautiful, open, meditative landscape, which when I arrived in September 2014 was covered with pink heather. So because all the buildings were burnt down in May 1945, there is nothing there. It's not like people's images of Auschwitz with either real or facsimile huts. Bergen-Belsen is an empty site. But what I discovered was that my father's hospital, which had been beautifully appointed, was part of what had been the Wehrmacht barracks up the road, which became the displaced persons camp. So I did quite a lot of work subsequently in the United Nations archives, because my father had worked for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. So he was medical superintendent, not at the time of liberation, but in the next wave of medical support from August, September 45 through the first difficult winter into the spring of 1946. And so it was by going looking for his history, I went into the hospital, which is an appallingly vandalised building these days. And when I went there as part of the anniversary group in 2015, going for the Bergen-Belsen anniversary, I met a group of people who call themselves Babies. The Babies is an international unofficial organisation of maybe 2,000 people who were born post-liberation in the displaced persons camp. And, of course, some of them were born while my father was hospital superintendent.
There was a baby boom.
There was indeed a post-liberation baby boom, and some 2,000 babies were born in Belsen displaced persons camp. And one commentator uses the phrase procreation was another form of liberation. So while we've been talking all this dark history, there's also a very positive side to this story, which is about the survivors making their own freedom. And one of the ways they made their own freedom was by political agitation, but another way was by falling in love, getting married, having babies, starting new life. So very much by the spring of 1946, by the summer of 46, when my story ends, you've got the first new families coming. And I tell the story of some of these babies, some of these survivor families.
Nadia, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you, David.
I have been speaking to Nadia Weekly, author of Strange New World, Belsen's First Year of Freedom, which has just been published by Monash University Publishing. And I can guarantee you a surprise, if not a shock, on just about every page. And that's the show. On our next, we welcome back the great Irish journalist Fintan O'Toole, who lately has been pondering in the pages of the New York Review of Books a worry that's crossed my mind and yours many times. Might the President of the United States be mad? He has the answer.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.